Good evening, everybody. This is Monday night seminar number 24. We're back from seminar number 23, which was our media fast. We didn't do it. We refused to do it, stopping at 22. It is September the 19th, 2011. It's 7 o'clock in New York City. And this evening, we're with Bob Dobbs and a stack of lurkers that have yet to identify themselves. We're back from this media fast, and we're underway. Bob, so... This media fast had absolutely no effect on me, and I'm willing to bet that it had no effect on anybody else.
In what sense? Did you media? Was that the TV landscape, or did you mean the chip landscape? I don't think you withdrew from the chip landscape or your chip body.
No, I had a broadcast fast, and I did do 1 week of. I did a fast from these mum. Conversations for just over a month, 6 weeks it was, but it was a fairly haphazard fast or diet as per most people's approach to dieting.
So you're saying that McLuhan's prescription of turning off the environment, dimming it down, is not applicable?
Well, I don't know. I'm pondering to what extent it's possible or plausible or even viable today to even undertake this thing called a media fast. I mean, what the hell is it? What does it mean? Like when we talk about five bodies.
Yeah, what level of suicide are you willing to accomplish and accommodate, and which body you're going to drop? I want to make this statement is we did 22 mum symposia. And the initials of Marsh McLuhan, MM. M is the 13th letter, so that's 1-3. Then you get another M is 1-3. Now you subtract the 1 from 3 and you get a 2. And then you take the other M and you subtract the 1 from 3 and you get a 2. So actually MM is 22. That's one of the reasons the McLuhan quadrant has the number 22, along with Zappa in that quadrant. And we did 22 sessions. And in my media fast, I did do a media fast to this extent. When I went away, I had no computer and I had no cell phone or anything. Nobody could get to me, but I could get to them if I wanted to by using somebody else's phone. So I did disconnect for 4 weeks from August 13th, Sue Bowen's birthday, to a few days ago.
And so did it have any physiological effects on you, or in what sense were you impacted on by taking this break, Bob?
It had no effect on me because after a few weeks, I would talk to Carolyn, and she would do some chip body stuff that was required. And she went on to my Facebook, answered things, answered some emails. So I couldn't disconnect completely for very long on the chip body level, but I had no input in the regular media, but I created media like we did at the Zappanally on August 20th. Now, what happened, my great synchronistic luck, is while I was in London, August was 17th, I think, August 16th, and then a little while later, when I went back to London, I got to see at the Tate Britain, which is the older Tate Museum, not the new one, the Tate Modern, they had an exhibit of the Vortices, the Wyndham Lewis gang, right there in London.
At the Tate.
Who went, whoa?
That would be Sheila.
Very good, Sheila. Yeah, like, the Wyndham Lewis and the Vortices have been suppressed for, 80 years or something. Wyndham Lewis tried to have his portrait shown in 1938 on a major museum in London, and it was stopped because he had such a bad reputation from his journalistic career. And he had paintings of famous, like T.S. Eliot and everybody. And so nothing had really been attributed to Lewis for all this time until 2008. I was in London, that was the last time, in April, and they had the exhibition of the Camden Group. The Camden Group were the artists that were happening in 1909 to 1912 in London that Lewis, returning from Europe after being away for like 7 years, he hijacked that group to make the Vortices. So I got to see the people before Lewis, and that was great in 2008. And then a year or so ago, they finally had a big exhibition of Wyndham Lewis's portraits. You remember reading about that, Andrew?
Yes.
Yeah, year and a half ago, they finally showed all the stuff that was suppressed in 1938. So there was a revival of Lewis going on. And I didn't know that the third phase, the Vortices thing, would happen. But when I got to London, I saw it, and I said, wow, what luck. So I showed up to see. I missed the portraits. I didn't get to London a year ago because of you, Sheila, and other people.
Because of me?
Yeah, too busy serving your requirements. And but it was such a great predestined luck thing that there it is, and it was a really great exhibit, and I went there, and they had this incredible coffee table book, you know, like $50 or maybe $70, dollars, 50 pounds, 40 pounds. And on one foldo page inside of this great big book, they had a photograph of every book that Lewis did, all laid out in order, all 50, 70 books. It was incredible, just on one page. These are books that you're very hard to find now. And so just for that, I had to buy it. But they had all kinds of other stuff and new essays. So it was really great timing to see this and to be doing this during the media fast, Andrew. This is the guy, Wyndham Lewis, who set up the option, the idea of doing that. This is where McLuhan got it from. And Lewis also wrestled with the improbableness of being able to pull it off. So I got to see, you know, it was like I'm in the Truman Show, right? Whatever I'm involved in, then reality, some level reality provides a scenario for me. So I got to walk around with, and Sue Bone was there. I met her in London. She was flying around. And she came second time. So go to the Tate Britain. They probably have, I think it ended around the middle of September, and read whatever summaries in that they say about the exhibit. Maybe they have archives like the Museum of Modern Art and the Metropolitan. You can go and see a lot of the things on their website. Now, in the middle of this exhibit, I got in touch with Alan Mutton, who is one of the top, if not the top, Lewis scholar. And he wrote the essay, Andrew, about a couple months ago, I awarded as the best one for the McLuhan Centenary for what he contributed, how Wyndham Lewis influenced both Orwell and who else? Orwell and who was the other guy? Don't remember. Anyways, McLuhan. Orwell and McLuhan. Two opposites presented in the media in the 80s. In the middle of this, the BBC or some major program had an art reviewer come on, and he's the royal acknowledged art critic, came on BBC, and he, you know, slandered Lewis, brought out all the old stuff that was claimed about Lewis in the 30s. And this outraged the Wyndham Lewis Society, which Alan Mutton is a member of. Maybe I'll post a link. You can go to that website and hear the outrage of people respond to this guy, writing letters, making other kinds of video and audio. And so there was a big row over Lewis again in the middle of this exhibit, which had been on from June to September. So that was an interesting effect right there.
Hey, Bob, can you just refine, how do you say that it was Lewis that gave McLuhan the foundation or possibility to generate and propagate this meme of the media fast? Why is Lewis the original for this approach to our media environments?
Well, in 1926, he put out the book, The Art of Being Ruled, which McLuhan, in his first known letter to Harold Innes in March 1951, he told Harold Innes, and he was beginning to move closer to Innes and be influenced by him and to exploit him and all this, so he's being very careful, but he pointed out to Lewis, to Innes, that Wyndham Lewis's Art of Being Ruled was the most important document since Machiavelli's The Prince, which was like 400 years before. So McLuhan said that he took, in general, broad summary of that book. He said Lewis shows how to find the human scale in the new technological gargantuan leviathan, the new technoscape. He found human scale in that, which is pretty interesting because most people were intimidated by the media net, you know, throughout the 20th century. Now, you got to read Lewis to figure out what that means. But first of all, Lewis was the first as an artist to say, and he criticized Picasso and a lot of artists of Europe, that they were still making their art in studios and still painting. He said the artist, if it has a true genius perception, genius sensibility that would be useful to the body politic, they have to go into city hall, government, whatever it is, and be an advisor as an architect, as a designer of the city. They should start molding city environments. Lewis perceived the city as an art form because the new city, the hidden city, which he called Magnetic City, was being created by automobiles, movies, telephone, and radio. And so because that environment was pretty hard to manage, then you got to change the environment that you can work with, which was the city. So the artist, as McLuhan said, Lewis was the first to treat the media en bloc. That's a French phrase, E-N-B-L-O-C. So Lewis, in The Art of Being Ruled, starts describing the effects of the electric environment all across all the institutions and explaining some of the symptoms, like the retrieval of the child cult, the feminization of men, all these things that you see echoes of in Marshall's Mechanical Bride in 1951. But anyways, he started to show the effects of media and laid out the stakes. He said, if we do allow this electric media just to keep happening like this, then we will be changed and all our civilized values will be lost. And he adopted the strategy of being for certain civilized values around the eye. And he said the ear was going to take over and just change everything. And he was the only person talking about this stuff. And now Alan Munton, he found this letter from Orwell to a friend of his, a woman friend, in the 30s, in the mid-30s, saying, you know, maybe Wyndham Lewis is not insane. Maybe he has a point. I've been rereading his essays, and I think we have to consider this. So here's this letter that no one knew about, that George Orwell is admitting that Lewis saw something that would inspire Orwell to attempt his warning of media landscapes called Newspeak in his novel 1984. And that's a big discovery because...
Yeah, huge discovery.
Yeah, and you saw that a couple months ago when I posted it, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and so you have... And so what happened in the 1980s is when nuclear disarmament and the nuclear peace movement started, there were a lot of editorials, and Derek de Kirchhoff wrote one for New York Times, and a lot of op-ed things about whether we were going into an Orwellian nightmare or into a McLuhan non-nightmare. They still had the image that McLuhan was some kind of a Pollyanna optimist or something, though de Kirchhoff knew better. But anyways, you had McLuhan versus Orwell in the 80s over what to do about the Reagan image-inspired Star Wars and nuclear war scenario. And so nobody knew back then that the two icons for this debate, McLuhan and Orwell, were both influenced by Lewis. Now, Orwell, his book comes out in 1948-49, and immediately McLuhan mocks it. We have a couple of quotes available and says, Orwell doesn't have a clue what's going on, and he's worried about something that happened 50 years ago. So right at the same time, McLuhan is telling Innes in 1951 that there's a human scale. There is a different way to look at the electric media, and it's not a fearful projection that Orwell made. So there it is. Lewis was interpreted one way by Orwell and interpreted another way by McLuhan, which is a fantastic scenario that should be taught in any form of education that's still around for people to have a perspective.
I would tend to refine that. I think Croker extended the more subtle McLuhan approach that is both Orwellian nightmare and Huxleyan pleasure palace kind of thing. It's I think in McLuhan you've got those both sides, but it's definitely the cliched version of McLuhan that comes out of the 60s, that is the McLuhan that thought that that TV was a utopia type situation, that with the image of McLuhan that was propped up throughout, I guess, the 60s all the way through to the 80s, that version of McLuhan is seen as opposite to Orwell.
Right. And maybe even Orwell is not the way Madison Avenue presents him. I'm not a scholar on Orwell, so I haven't read 1984 in 50 years.
He's pretty complex. Like he's got pretty wide ranging in terms of what he was dealing with.
Right. So you bring up Croker. That's what I'm leading to. I'm changing Mum McLuhan on Maui to Mum M-U-N McLuhan under Maui. Because I have not used McLuhan terminology or McLuhan perspectives in 20 years. I did when I first went on the radio in the mid-80s because nobody knew anything about McLuhan. But once Arthur Croker's book, Data Trash, came out in 1994, I knew that we had a better thinker, more comprehensive thinker, more up-to-date thinker, and who provided a language that McLuhan could not provide. I think it's very appropriate that Marshall died in 1980. When you look at his essays in the late 70s, he's tidying up his own work and completing his work and putting complexities in it. But you, after 20 years of reading a lot of postmodern kind of critics and their complexity basically coming out of Paris, you go back and read McLuhan's stuff, it's children's writing. It is so tiny. Now, the percept is very important, the percept of understanding McLuhan. But to see, you cannot see how McLuhan could write anything in the 80s and 90s to come anywhere near what Baudrillard, Foucault, Derrida, Deleuze and Guattari, and later Croker were writing. And we were becoming a more Baroque society in the 80s in the sense that people had more leisure time. They had more time to read more complex, complicated prose. And McLuhan, even in Laws of Media, predicted that studies, academic studies, would become medievalist and Baroque. It has that. He has that in one of the tetrads in Laws of Media. He predicts the complexification of left hemisphere thinking was inevitable in the 80s and 90s. But so there's no way you can talk in the limited categories of hot and cool media, acoustic and visual space, sensory extensions, media. These do not work.
I'd half agree there, Bob, because I think you're kind of genius in pointing out that there was that window of opportunity between the 80s and 90s for that more complex Baroque book orientated view. But I think everybody's saying at the moment is with iPods, with Kindles, this, that, and the other thing, we've gone way back the other way. It seems that window is shut right down, particularly in the last 5 years. For even last 3 years.
Yeah, you mean of... Now this is for university culture, which I want to supplement that by saying that Marshall's last great discovery in 1970, aside from completing the tetrad, was to point out that the university was the new city. The city, the metropolitan hardware environment, was obsolesced by the magnetic or electric city, but the in-between place of processing information went to the city. And that's why anybody growing up in North America and probably in Europe had to get to university, because you were not a citizen. You were part of what Croker would call the dispossessed. If you did not get into the university world and get a degree, that was your passport to membership in the modern civilization. And so the city, universities became huge places. And so much of media was around the famous people who end up teaching university, what happened to the students there, what happened to the corporations taking over universities. The university is the ground for what we'll call it a figure ground, a second-order ground, not the real ground, a second-order ground in the 70s up till recently. And so there was lots, you could say that most of the culture of the last 30 years was created out of universities. Many of the artists who didn't get to be teachers end up having no money. I personally know Carolee Schneeman, a great artist, performance artist from the 60s, told me this. And I made fun of Michael Snow because his wife was one of these culture administrators in the university environment, and Michael wasn't. And Michael would have to go to these professors who would use the artist as fodder for the kids to have content for the classroom. And yet the artist would have be struggling to get some money to survive, while the professor had good income and increasing income. So the university professors became the new curators. And this turned art galleries and that whole scene outside of the university into a manic, crazy excess orgy of commodification of old art. Anyways, the city is ground, Andrew, allowed the Baroque replay of all the old Gutenberg arts, including economics, politics, all the disciplines. That was being superseded slowly by the internet as the real university, to the point when now where the internet is the university and is struggling itself to survive as any meaningful point of communication, that leaves the Baroque world of the city as university as city, gone. Do you see what I mean? It's been budget cutted. And you personally know there's a new austerity going on in the university as city across the world, where they're like bringing in very strict controls like they did with the welfare state in the 70s and 80s in North America. It was very hard to stay a long time in unemployment and a lot of hassle of the welfare. Now that the information welfare state, the university, is under austerity conditions, that has changed the freedom for people to be Baroque in, I guess you'd call it.
It's almost like space itself. Any space has become a disservice and it's become a liability.
Right.
Anything that's material is just a cost.
Any chemical body. That's right.
Anything that's physical. Hey, anyway, Bob, let's temporarily see whether there's anybody else who's got a question. Like we're monopolizing conversation. Please do not be polite if you're on the listening end. Just get on in there. Interrupt. Okay, that went nowhere.
Nobody has anything to say?
I have a question that's unrelated.
Yeah,
okay.
No, everything's related. Get in there.
That's my favorite museum in London, the Tate Britain. Did you see the Turner collection when you were there?
No, I didn't go to any other collections. I've been there before many years ago, but I don't recall anything special about the Turner collection.
Oh, just vast.
Okay.
So Wyndham Lewis, there were none of his portraits? Is that what you said?
Yeah, none of his portraits. It was not all Wyndham Lewis. It was all the vortices. Epstein, Gaudier, Brzezinski, other artists, Wadsworth. It was the whole crew of the vortices. Their work. Many many artifacts of that. Lewis wasn't the only guy, but Lewis is the one that they have the huge book for, because he actually produced such an output that the others didn't. Lewis is the only one who stayed in the art game more than the others. So I wanted to say, so Sheila, what's interesting, there is a revival of interest in Lewis, and I keep thinking of the phrase that McLuhan made for him. McLuhan called him a one-man army corps, and he worked in many media. That is actually what people can do with Web 2.0. They're one man, one person, army corps, creating all kinds of media. That autonomous and manipulative position, it would seem that Lewis is an archetype, a prototype for that. So the one-man army corps, which is what everybody can do when they have their Web 2.0 set up, Lewis is actually, his sensibility has arrived as the resonant figure for what's going on in the chip body. What do you think of that, Andrew?
Yeah, nice. I mean, it's interesting, I guess, then, if Finnegan's Wake is emerging as normal and everyday awareness, then naturally it flicks back to Lewis, comes back on the agenda as well.
Yeah, we're into the Lewis area, post-Joycean. I guess Don Thiel will have to be reincarnated and change his book title to The Lewis Era, the era of post-information now and post-communication. So this comes into Croker. Croker himself is much like Lewis as a personality. Have you ever seen any indication of him? You haven't met him personally, have you, Andrew?
Who?
Arthur Croker.
No, I haven't.
Have you picked up anything about his personality from the video you've seen of him?
No, I get a general sense of, I guess, the trajectory of his career. I was really, I first read Croker in the late 90s, and he was a little bit beyond me then. Then when I came back to him, I found him, he was the guy. He was just light years ahead of everybody, particularly even the French, but he wasn't getting any attention. And then lately he seems to have shifted into a statesman political kind of role.
Right now, when did you reread him? A year ago? When did you make this appreciation?
No, it would have been about 4 years ago. Like, I started a slow but steady rereading of Croker.
Right. Okay, so that's why I'm going to emphasize Croker from now on, because the one obvious lacuna or missing element of this whole McLuhan centenary is Croker. He's not invited to any of the McLuhan celebrations. He may have been invited, turned them down. I know he turned down the one in 1998 that Lance put on at Fordham. That was a big one with 45 McLuhan scholars. He was invited but turned it down. He keeps his distance from the McLuhan scene, though he did in 1998 or late 1999, he did go to de Kerckhoff's conference in Toronto, and I attended that at the University of Toronto. And the whole gang of them, what we call the diasporic school, Logan, de Kerckhoff, and not Bruce Powell wasn't there, but that gang, they all turned on Croker. He gave his presentation, and then they all got silly, and a whole story happened there, which I came in and helped solve, but we'll maybe do that some other time. But Croker's always been ostracized by the so-called McLuhan experts, just like McLuhan was ostracized by the communication schools and the media schools. It's the same situation.
Yeah, but it's very tribal, I believe. It's very irrational. I've come across a lot of people that say they really, really dislike Croker, but nobody who can actually pinpoint them and clearly articulate why or what it is.
Yeah, for this new direction I want to take my part involved in MUM, I reread Data Trash this weekend, and that is such an incredible manifesto written in the early 90s before Wired and before Netscape, which got everybody on the computer in 95, 96. Before all that, he lays out prophetically where we are today, you know, in 2011. It's exactly like McLuhan's writings, 20 years ahead of everybody, describing a detailed history of the future because he knows the nature of the present. Now, I'd also like to know a bit more about Michael Weinstein, who is the co-author of that book. All I know, he's a photographer in Chicago, was the last I heard. I met his wife, Dina Weinstein, at a conference of rock criticism at DIA, which is set up by Ted Carpenter, the late Ted Carpenter's... did Ted Carpenter pass on our media fast? Or did we announce it just before in our last session?
He passed just before.
Yeah, so it'll probably get talked about. It happened in July. Anyways, he's married into the Demoneal family, who created the DIA Foundation, the Lourdes, L-O-U-R-D-E-S, of art in New York City, and responsible for everybody from Warhol to you, Andrew. This DIA Foundation... what was I saying? I forgot why I brought this up. Dia Carpenter, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. So I met Dina Weinstein at a conference Dia put on in Chelsea in New York in, I don't know, 2000 or so. And I accused her of being a genetic engineer while she was up on her doing her panel, which is directly out of her husband's writings. And she didn't have, she faked possum. She didn't have a clue. Pretended she didn't have a clue what I was talking about. And after the conference, when everybody's just smooching and mingling, I noticed her coming over at one point. She was a short woman, and she just spied on me and eavesdropped while I talked to different people, including the famous Village Voice critic Robert Christgau. And she was just sitting there, and after a while, she had this funny smirk on her face as she sort of winsomely listened to me but wouldn't engage me. So she wanted to find out who this guy was and knew the secret code. So Michael Weinstein, he co-wrote it with Arthur, but I don't know where he is or how much he did in it, and there's nothing on him about him in the Internet. So he's an interesting missing factor. He could be like the Ted Carpenter in relation to Marshall. You know, Marshall's Croker. Ted Carpenter, he claims he wrote part of Understanding Media, and that's why it has an erratic style. Michael Weinstein is someone that some scholar could do a PhD on if they could find him. So why was telling you that?
Weinstein was the missing factor in this. We were discussing the general arc or career of Croker in view of his 20-year prophetic vision pre-riot.
Right, that's probably Jake. Could you put yourself on mute, please, if that's Jake? The thing about, okay, what was you were just saying, the missing, the other missing factor in Croker's academic career is David Cook. David Cook, I've met and been at his home with Arthur Croker and Mary Louise. That was at that conference at York in 97 that Bruce Powell put on. David Cook was, I think he's a little older than Arthur, but he told me he was the one who discovered French postmodern literature first in the 70s, and Arthur was a professor out in Winnipeg, and where McLuhan grew up, and Croker had been born in Red Rock, a nowhere place, a little town up near Thunder Bay or someplace way, in the wilderness of the huge province of Ontario. And Arthur told me he read Medium is Massaged in 67 while working in a pulp mill. You know what I mean? Like reading it while making sure he didn't get his leg sawn off. And he said, I didn't know what McLuhan was talking about. It's really interesting to see how McLuhan was an invisible environment and nobody could understand what he's saying. And it's very obvious now. Just like for you, you couldn't understand Croker in the late 90s, but then 10 years later you could. Easily. So that's the point of new art. It's always not easy to register, usually conceptually for people. So anyways, David Cook told me that he got together, he became friends of Arthur Croker, and he said, we've got to bring a Canadian factor into this new kind of studies that are going on. And a lot of it's about media. So they started the Journal of Political and Social Theory, I think it's called. Do you remember the exact title, Andrew? Canadian Journal?
That's pretty close to it.
Yeah. Anyways, they started that while Croker was in Winnipeg, I think, in 76, 77. And they infiltrated the whole postmodern scene, David Cook and Arthur. And David Cook was the one who introduced a lot of these writers to Arthur. And they built up a respectable profile in peer-reviewed journals by the early 80s. But all the while, Croker was sneaking in with a different agenda. Now, David Cook told me that Arthur was a better writer than Cook. And so over time, Arthur gets, even though he was influenced by Cook, he goes on to create his own voice. And he puts out a book in 1984 called Canada... Technology in the Canadian Mind. Is that what it is?
Yep.
Technology in the Canadian... Yeah, about three Canadian academics, Harold Innes, Marsh McLuhan, and George Grant. I think Croker might have been a student of Grant because I know Croker went to McMaster in the early 70s in Hamilton, Ontario, and I think Grant was a professor there around that time. So anyways, here I remember seeing this interview on Robert Fulford's TV show in Toronto in 1984. I was amazed that somebody was talking about McLuhan, because McLuhan had gone through real suppression and been kicked off the radar, the scanning TV body radar, and all of a sudden this guy's there being interviewed, and at the end of his interview, he made a very interesting statement. He said McLuhan was betrayed by advanced capitalism, or betrayed by the class of advanced capitalism. And you never heard that kind of talk, in the media. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty interesting statement. How was he betrayed? What's that about? I mean, I knew, but I never heard anybody say this. So from that point on, I got Croker's book, and I start reading him. And what was really good about that book is that he recognized the Thomistic, or the doctrine of the analogy of proportions among proportions. He recognizes it.
He's an ex-seminarian. He's got that edge. He's ex-seminarian. He's Canadian, and his wife's a designer. He had the fast track.
That's right. He had gone. He'd been a candidate for to be a priest, growing up Catholic, and he left the priesthood and then went on to the other side. became a Marxist. And, you know, it definitely has no truck with religion, and that's always satirized in his, or attacked blatantly in his writings. But the he learned probably some of the Thomistic and Augustinian themes that are very important in his work. But he was the first to intelligently discuss McLuhan's tactile sensibility. I mean, Coker even knew it was tactility. And talking to Don Thiel a few years later, he was impressed with that too, you know, that someone actually had done their homework with McLuhan and got some of the basics. So Coker was someone to watch. And then he burst on the scene in 1986 with The Postmodern Scene, which was a collection of essays by him and David Cook, which was astounding and way beyond what de Kirchhoff, Logan, or anybody in the McLuhan, in the Toronto School of Mediaecology, or the Diasporic School, or the New York School. Well, no, the New York School was happening. That was Senior Text and Severo Lutrenci and the French Postmodernists. But it came at a new level. And Barry Nevitt, by this time, sometime in the early 80s, Coker transferred to become a professor at Concordia in Montreal. And Barry Nevitt had a friend, Dennis Murphy, who would have Barry Nevitt come in and speak to his class all through the 80s. Sometime in the middle 80s, Barry Nevitt said to me, you know, there's nothing happening here at the University of Toronto or the Cochos with Derek de Kirchhoff and David Olson. They're doing nothing. But it's really happening in Concordia. And he never said the name Arthur Coker, but later, as I became more aware of what Coker could do, I thought that's what Barry was referring to. He knew there was a ferment happening in what I call the Montreal School of Mediaecology. He was aligned more with Dennis Murphy, a little more conservative thinker, but Coker definitely probably attended some of Barry Nevitt's lectures or was aware of people who did and picked up on that and maybe even looked at Barry Nevitt's book and saw that they were very good exegesis of McLuhan, but they didn't serve the issue of what had to be done in the 80s.
So is that the fruits, Bob, of when Don Thiel didn't get that appointment at UFT, I think. Was it UFT? And then he went up to Montreal, and then he was running some seminars up at Montreal on Monday nights, I understand it as well.
Let me give you that history. In 62-63, Marshall McLuhan, his colleague in the Department of English at the University of Toronto, always had a problem with Don because Don did not include Wyndham Lewis in his PhD in 1953-54. Don did not have time to include Lewis, but McLuhan wanted, McLuhan being the guide of the PhD, McLuhan wanted Lewis being there. He got a bit suspicious of Don for not doing that. So there was tension between Don and Marshall through the late 50s, even to the point when CBC asked Don to do a report on McLuhan, and McLuhan saw the report and saw that Don pretty accurately explained what McLuhan was doing. McLuhan took Don aside and told him, don't do that. Don't explain what I'm doing. You must have a mystery factor in here. And so he chided Don for betraying more about what Marshall was doing than Marshall wanted out. So there was this tension. So it got to the point in 62, 63, where Don should have become eligible to teach the modernist, you know, the vorticists, the Eliots and Pound Lewis's and that stuff, in the Catholic part of the University of Toronto called St. Michael's College. He wanted to teach that stuff, and the administration was going to allow him to have a course, and McLuhan intervened and stopped it. He would not let Don do what Marshall was doing, the modernists. So Don realized at that point that he would never get any upper mobility in that department at St. Michael's, so he looked around, and fortunately, York University just opened in about 1964. That was a new big university on the suburbs of Toronto that was probably influenced more, Lynn LaRouche would say, by British intelligence and the left perspective to counter the conservative establishment at the University of Toronto. So Don got a gig at the York University where he started a seminar, much like what McLuhan had done in the 50s, and McLuhan was trying to do a little bit in the 60s of bringing in advanced experts and creators of the most advanced parts of society and have them be interprofessional, interdisciplinary, and discuss what they're doing. He pulled that off for a year or so in 65, 66, and Marshall, I don't know if Marshall was irritated by it, but one of the members of that seminar that Don started was Patrick Watson, who was the the Dan Rather of Canadian TV at that time, a major performer on CBC, and he had this show called This Hour Has 7 Days, and that became a major news show, and a lot of great footage of the 60s comes out of that show because they were well-funded, and they went all over the world and caught a lot of the interesting events of the 60s, and they weren't controlled like the Americans were in their studios. So that TV show, Don Thiel's group, because Patrick Watson was part of his seminar, would allow them to see the footage before the show or see it right after. And so they were able to discuss the word that was making the Canadian market. That show was a big factor in Canadian identity. And it's a show, on that show, This Hour of 7 Days, on the very first show, they featured McLuhan. So any of the footage you see of McLuhan, black and white footage, some of it is from that show. And it may be even Patrick Watson interviewing or Robert Fulford. And remember, it's Fulford, 20 years later, who's interviewing Arthur Croker in 1984-85. So Don Thiel, he was actually in touch with the media level, which McLuhan wanted all the time, at that point at York. And so he got scouted by McGill University Montreal to come there. And so he goes to Montreal, and at the same time, Expo 67 is being created. And so Don becomes a major advisor on that, and it's called McLuhan's Fair, because McLuhan's a big influence in this world exhibit called Expo 67. And so Don spends a lot of time in 67 doing that. Then he starts teaching in 68 in McGill, and he's the first to have a, would you call it a PhD program, Andrew? A PhD program around media studies in Canada.
Yep. Yeah, so that was a big deal, like in terms of in university terms.
Yeah, and even in the letters you can read it. I think it's public. We have it at least privately. Is that McLuhan wrote his own president of the University of Toronto and bitterly complained that a student of his gets to go and Don Thiel was the first PhD student of.
Yeah, that was a voice that just chimed in there, Bob. Just somebody semi-introduced themselves.
Who was that?
Oh, it sounded like James.
Okay. McLuhan, this is in 71 or so, McLuhan's complaining about how Don Thiel gets to have a PhD program, and he's a student of mine. Why can't I get one? And so he was really pissed at Don. And at the same time, he caused a big flack by objecting to Don's book on McLuhan in 1970-71. And that book required the mediation of 5 university presidents to solve that one. And anyways, Don Thiel goes on to influence a lot of people in Montreal in the 70s, and Croker knew Don Thiel. So we're saying that Don Thiel laid the groundwork for the Montreal School of Media Ecology, which Croker surfed, and Don was one of the few people of an older generation who recognized the abilities of Arthur Croker.
Yeah, so in a sense, was it fair to say you reckon that Thiel created the audience for Croker, or at least created just enough there so that just enough good soil that Croker's would find an audience?
Probably through David Cook, who was an administrator at the University of Toronto in the 60s, 70s, in this period, and a teacher, I guess, sometimes. I knew him later as a teacher. He was certainly aware of McLuhan and all that stuff. He may have been the one to be influenced by Don Thiel, because David Cook went on to write a book on Northrop Frye, which Don Thiel was the only academic who was close to both Frye and McLuhan. That's what's interesting, that he was in between the big divide in intellectual literary activity in Canada between Northrop Frye and Marshall McLuhan. So David Cook would know about Don Thiel just because he studied Northrop Frye. Okay, so maybe you could you could say some things, Andrew. What I'm going to do eventually before we finish is I'm going to take the glossary of items from Data Trash and start reading some of the definitions of Croker's language.
Well, let's get there now, Bob. Like, I think we've done a really nice history in terms of, in fact, we've taken an hour and we've talked about how Croker potentially goes beyond McLuhan. We've laid some of the ground, and demonstrated that he definitely comes out of McLuhan. So yeah, let's get there straight away and see if it invokes anything.
Right. I'm going to begin by page 142. What Croker develops is what's called crash theory. Not postmodern theory or paramodern theory, but crash theory. And here's how he introduces it on page 142 of Data Trash, which came out in 1994, but was probably written in 91, 92, 93. He says, Tired de Chardin's Noosphere, in quotes, Noosphere, Marsh McLuhan's Global Village, in quotes. So he cites those two things, and he says, The notion of an emergent form of being that comes out of the human in quotes, and surpasses it. So he's talking about the noosphere and the Global Village are the notion of an emergent form of being that comes out of the human and surpasses it. Then Croker celebrates a 19th century philosopher, Samuel Alexander, quotes his thesis on the deity, and says, so he says, Samuel Alexander's deity and all the other gods, in quote gods, that humans are supposed to bring into being and which were in the minds of William James, Henri Bergson, Unamuno, a Spanish philosopher, and Alexander Whitehead. For the most part, these theories, these themes, were evolutionary and progressive. Also Hegelian, says Croker. Then he says, just because the human will be decentered and surpassed by a new mode of being does not mean that the human will be diminished. On the contrary, it will come into its own as collaborator in something greater, an honored collaborator. William James's God was a friend and a partner who needed us. Alexander Whitehead's God was fulfilled only in its consequent nature through our efforts. So it had this vision. It's what he's going to call emergentism, these theoreticians of emergentism. He's going to fit McLuhan into that meme. And up before McLuhan, the idea is that the human will not be diminished by this new being. All right, he then begins the second paragraph saying, McLuhan's technological humanism stands at the end of this modernist discourse, as opposed to postmodern discourse. All the other emergentists, the ones I just named, were visionary anticipators with theological imaginations. However, in McLuhan, the noosphere materializes as the media net. The emergent is no longer to be striven for as something in the future, but is now a fact. McLuhan is the moment of positivistic emergentism. Positivistic is a term referring to empirical science. It's a type of science. You have to remember, Croker is a political economist and a sociologist, so he will talk technically sometimes in his language, even though this is a book for anybody. So he has positivistic in quotes, in italics, so it doesn't mean being optimistic. It's a kind of practical, sensory-based view of reality, and it's called positivism. So he says, McLuhan is the moment of positivistic emergentism. He is reporting the fact that there is a mode of being that has succeeded and now encompasses the human. But he's still a humanist. He is still a doctor. He needs to prescribe. For him, there is a common sense which might be trained to respond to the distortions created by technology and to restore its homeostasis through an intelligible media diet. That's what we call media ecology. Croker adds, McLuhan believes the media might yet serve man in quotes. So then Croker states what he's about, crash theory. He says, cross McLuhan's nervous system odorized by the media with Nietzsche's last man in quotes. The last man is the first unequivocal sighting of the recliner. So Croker's going to go on to explain that we're not into the Spengler's The Decline of the West, we're into the recline of the West. So you cross McLuhan with Nietzsche's Last Man, who is conceptually the first unequivocal sighting of the recliner, and you get crash theory. This is how it happens, Croker writes. Crash theory is the post-humanist, not anti-humanist. What is there to be against if the human is dead and now a subject of endless resurrection effects? See, there's your archetypal cliche probes retrieval. You will see the tetrad embedded all through Croker's writing. What is there to be against if the, quote, human, unquote, is dead and now a subject of endless resurrection effects? So crash theory is the post-humanist continuation of emergentism. It follows McLuhan's odorization thesis, but extends and elaborates it by calling attention to how the media net is constituted by technologies that were not in McLuhan's ken or knowledge or experience. Crash theory, however, abandons the notion that media are extensions of man. Far from it. They are humiliations of the flesh, which remain as an embarrassment after man dies. So the point is that these extensions invade the human body, or what I call the chemical body. So Coker says, the crash has happened. The emergence of the media net is accompanied by the onset of reclining life. Rather than McLuhan's Hegelian vision of a common sense restored, italicized, restored by and through the media, a media net scans, sucks, and probes the body for more images and bytes, B-Y-T-E-S, to be archived, called up, recombined, run, and archived in cyclical processes leading nowhere. That is non-history. So he goes on, and that's the bigger view. So some people would say that Croker is just taking that part of McLuhan that notes the disservices of media. But Croker goes further. He says that the technological environment has come alive and has turned vicious and is biting the hand that fed it and chewing it and dispensing it. So it's a science fiction or a Cronenberg kind of scenario. Now I will go to his data trash glossary. Anything you want to say at that point, Andrew, at this point?
No, I'd quite like if you just read that through again real quick, Bob. It was quite nice. And I was noting how Croker's structuring it phrases, how the tetrad is embedded in there. He's going round and round and round, but a very, it's quite clinical and formulaic the way he's developing his prose.
Yeah. And it's like McLuhan used to say, serious books he would read every other page because they tend to repeat themselves. Well, Croker definitely has a small vocabulary and repeats himself, but it's very tactile the way he moves the relations between the electronic body, the telematic body, the virtual body, the physical body. He's playing up into different aspects of a mosaic or moire where things are overimposed like homologies. And so you want me to read his definition, not the introductory part, but what he said about himself. You want that reread?
Yeah. Okay. It was good. Like, without the interjection, we had, like, the commentary. So, like, let's just get the text.
Yeah, so he says, you want me to repeat what I said. For crash theory, you cross McLuhan's nervous system authorized by the media with Nietzsche's Last Man, the first unequivocal sighting of the recliner, and you get crash theory. This is how it happens. Crash theory is the post-humanist, not anti-humanist. What is there to be against if the human is dead and now a subject of endless resurrection effects? Crash theory is the post-humanist continuation of emergentism. It follows McLuhan's autorization thesis and extends and elaborates it by calling attention to how the media net is constituted by technologies that were not in McLuhan's ken. Crash theory, however, abandons the notion that media are extensions of man. Far from it. They are humiliations of the flesh, which remains as an embarrassment after man in quotes, dies. The crash has happened. Now, this is 20 years ago. The crash has happened. It goes with what I say, the Android meme was from 1960 to 1990 on my chart, and then you have the after image of the Android meme from 90 to 2020, or maybe even 2012. But the point is that the crash has happened in the early 90s when Croker's writing this. The emergence of the media net is accompanied by the onset of reclining life. Rather than McLuhan's Hegelian vision of a common sense restored by and through the media, a media net scans, sucks, and probes the body for more images and bytes to be archived, called up, recombined, run, and archived again, and cyclical processes leading nowhere. That is non-history. And then just I'll read the next little bit. History is an irrelevancy. History is an irrelevancy because its subject man is no longer the protagonist of anything but cynical dramas on the media net and dead ideologies. There is no protagonist, but there is a mode of being emergent from the flesh that displaces all protagonists. Telematic being has no history because its only principle is the endless exchange of data combined in every possible form. Any of the directions that it seems to take are determined by the vicissitudes of the reclining flesh, which provides it with a rotting biological infrastructure, a resource base, and an incitement for resource organization. Now, this can be applied to Finney's Wake, and that was the one criticism Don Thiel had of Croker's writings. He did not see that his vision was predicted, mimed by Finney's Wake. Okay, so anything you want to say?
Do you think that's borne out? Do you think that's legitimate? Because, like, in hearing how he writes, I'm getting an image of that, what is it, Austin Farah's diagram of the Book of Revelation, where the four quarters, and he's going round and round and round.
Right.
Thomas Croker's going round faster than McLuhan. Like, he's, instead of doing it at the level of the within the paragraph, he's at every sentence, he's ripping round that square.
That's right. And I interviewed Croker twice for Evan Ray's show back in 5 or 6 years ago, and on one of them we bring up James Joyce, and he says, yes, he's a student of Joyce now, and he's interested in Joyce in applications, but he never uses it. And this may be the reason. I was not aware of it. I wasn't in academia, but about 20 years ago, the feminists, the radical feminists, took over at least the humanities departments, and they got rid of Joyce, Eliot, and Pound, and Lewis. Well, Lewis wasn't even allowed in, but he got rid of these guys. And actually, in the 90s, Joyce was not someone encouraged to be quoted. Now, David Cook and Arthur Croker are putting on the whole postmodern milieu. They have an agenda, and they aren't going to make themselves easy butts of criticism by citing the old modernist guys, who actually were, the vortices were pre-modernists or post-modernists in their predictions, especially Lewis. But I think that he consciously dropped what Thiel required. And Don Thiel personally compelled me, and he was a president of a university. He saw the crashing, the smearing, the removal, the deleting of what he and Marshall had taught for decades and the modernist tradition. He saw that happen in the universities that he managed. So he was the one who told me about this reason why maybe Croker does not refer to it.
Well, I'm thinking of a nice guy to that matter would be John Fichette. I can't say his name. Fichette.
Yeah, Fichette.
He did two. I mean, a lot of people have not appreciated his work because he's supposedly from the communist camp. But he did two really good articles on McLuhan in some way, and he announces pretty much the collapse of that whole high modernist or late radical modernist situation, and I guess the leftist view of those figures. So and he published Massage in the Mass Age in the Canadian Journal of Political and Social Theory. So he is actually part of Croker's lineage.
Yeah, John Fichette, he's very involved with Don Thiel. In 68, when Don Thiel started to become a prominent teacher at McGill and the student radicalism was happening, John Fichette was a student of Don Thiel's, I think, who published some of Paul Krasner's The Realist pornographic satirical stuff in the student newspaper, and he got in big trouble. And Don Thiel became famous. I saw some of the newspaper articles of the time. He became famous as being the only professor who would support the radical students. So Don was identified as a Abby Hoffman kind of guy supporting the left students and anarchist students. So John Fichette got very involved with Don Thiel very early, learned a lot. I think Don even testified in whatever court or trial Fichette had to go through. Therefore was a very close friend of Don Thiel's, influenced in his understanding of McLuhan by Thiel, and would have liked Don Thiel's book on McLuhan, which was a leftist critique of McLuhan, sort of a para-leftist. So John Fichette ends up working at Trent University. I don't know if he was there before Don became president, but he was there after Don became president. So Don may have brought Fichette to Trent University, and Fichette was a friend of Croker and wrote for the early Journal of Political and Social Theory. So Fichette, he in 77 writes a book called The Critical Twilight, where he explains how Western literary criticism, the Eliots, the Pounds, and the McLuhans, end with McLuhan, and it's all over. And he then, I don't know if he is aware of postmodernism at that point, but he is making himself ripe for promoting the postmodernist view that's going to take over criticism in the 80s in America. Now, here's what happens. It's in 1982, right when McLuhan is not allowed to be discussed, but MTV has come in. MTV drew everybody, just like in 1989 when the Berlin Wall collapsed, it sort of took a few people back to look at McLuhan. And that's when Fichette, who really had criticized and dismissed McLuhan in 77 in his book, writes this essay in 82 saying, maybe we better relook at McLuhan. And he kind of, does a mea culpa and backs off. He never goes back into McLuhanism. He just sort of is guilty for what he had done in a way. But Croker goes further than Fiquette. What Fiquette couldn't do, Croker did. Croker knew how to remove McLuhan, yet take advantage of what he's saying. Whatever you just said a minute ago about Fiquette and McLuhan, is I don't think Fiquette understood McLuhan enough, and it was too late to...
Totally. I fully agree with that. But he does outline, he does provide a very clear outline how the supposed left apprehended those mainstays of McLuhan's discourses. You know, in terms of, he says why, I guess, the left is not pro the men of 1914.
Right, right. In other words, you're saying, Fiquette, I just want to say this. So you're saying that Fiquette was part of the charge that leads to the feminist takeover of academia. He's part of the early instigators of that.
I don't know whether he is. Actually, I don't know whether he's he can be afforded that. I would thought that's more Frederick Jamison and that sort of crowd. But I just found his way of writing really accessible. And insofar as he's dealing with McLuhan, it's just a nice entry into the matter.
Okay. So who? Somebody had a comment.
Things I didn't know.
I was just curious, this is Tina, what was it about MTV coming on television that caused some to revisit McLuhan? I'm not getting the connection.
Well, the popular image of McLuhan, once I was going through customs at the Toronto airport and I had my McLuhan archive with me, and the customs guy looks at it and he drifts through the articles that I collected on McLuhan, and he says, so this guy likes TV? that was his impression of McLuhan, a guy who liked TV. And so he let me take the documents through customs. But that's what you have to understand, Tina, is that McLuhan was seen as a guy, a crazy book professor, saying TV was useful, was good. People in academia did not say that. So because he was identified with TV, and these are very broad memes, so then when suddenly music is on TV, people think TV McLuhan. Oh, is this McLuhan
okay.
TV? I thought TV went away and we liked hi-fi stereo.
Which is why they called it MTV for McLuhan TV? No, I'm kidding.
No, that could be the unconscious. Yeah, the linguistic unconscious did that, but the guys who did it,
yeah.
They don't think they weren't doing that. But, in Canada, it became Much Music TV. There you got your MM, Much Music. So they might have had the McLuhan thing in there in Toronto, and they did know McLuhan.
<That's right. laughs> Okay.
But it's the shock. I mean, remember the song at the time was Video Killed the Radio. Video Killed the Radio was a popular song back then.
Yeah.
So it was a shock for people to think that they would sit and watch music. See, that was a shock to the senses, to the habits. You don't watch music.
You listen to it. It created a eye candy.
That's right. And you can even think of it as the first general experience of synesthesia. I mean, people think music is ear. Why would you look at it? You have to see. People are very simple in those days, in their sensory habits. And what? I'm watching something I should hear? And it became a big crisis. Even Zappa would complain about how video ruined music.
Before MTV showed up, and it also continues now, but there was, and I'm considering back in the late 60s and big time in the 70s, was going to rock concerts or music concerts every weekend or, 3 days a week. It's what filled my early adult life was, I bought a season pass to, to concert hall.
Okay. So you're saying you're watching music there?
And that kind of that preceded the MTV phase of,
Right. And this is where Croker comes in. Croker would call that FM radio or the concerts as the beginning of the virtualization turning into virtual reality the audio experience. So you can no longer talk about listening with your ears, natural sensory input. You are now getting techno input, which Coker calls virtual reality. So that was the beginning. And when you have a virtual experience, you begin to mix the old senses. So MTV is a synesthesia made possible by the chip landscape, by the virtualization of the body conditioning or the body rules. So the thing is that people said, wow, this is, and it's only someone like Fiquette who noticed this, because McLuhan wasn't in people's consciousness. But Fiquette had written a book a few years before sort of displacing McLuhan. And then so he, as a reasonably honest academic or intellectual, said, wait a minute, I think I might be wrong about McLuhan. Look what's happened. And so he had to apologize in 82 and that, but he never did much after that. But he always was at Trent and a good friend of Don Thiel's, and I don't know how he helped Don Thiel in academic life there. But there was another point.
Do you know if anyone noticed before MTV showed up that they were showing live concerts on regular TV?
Oh, that's what I wanted to tell you. That's what I wanted to mention here. To bring it close to 3 degrees of separation, the person who did the first videos for music in the early 70s was Robert Carr, the guy who influenced Dave Worster and had the Center of Integration in Seattle and in Portland.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, Robert Carr, who you can hear 22 hours of on Dobstown.com, he is an important part of the cosmic awareness scene. He was innovative in so many things. Like they did the first, they were doing the psychedelic rock concerts in the late 60s because he started in San Francisco, was beat out by Bill Graham, so he went up to Seattle and he was the first there. And they did so well that they were asked by some television network to broadcast their concerts, and that's where they put in all their light effects. And then he went on to make videos by 73, 74, and was working with Desi Arnaz's son, who wanted to market these. And so it was a bit ahead of his time.
I recall as a young teenager, still in high school, coming, you know, had to be home at midnight or something at 15 years old from a Friday night party, whatever, and we would tune into the...
Don Kirshner's rock thing.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was called, but every Friday night.
I think it was called Midnight Express. Was that one? Midnight Special? Something like that. But yeah, no, I used to see that. I know what you mean. Yeah, and you'd see. But the point is that you have this strange, you know, involvement behind the scenes of the whole Dave Worster world.
That blows me away, Bob. He pops up everywhere, unbeknownst to.
That's right. And that's why my interview with him in 1988 is called The Blacked Out History of the 20th Century. But Robert Carr was a medium in his early 20s. Then he was the first to work with psychedelics in a psychic context. And then he went on to start the hippie world down in San Francisco after hanging out with Alan Watts. And then he did his buddy, because Robert Carr had a printing place in San Francisco, they did the first psychedelic posters. And then they did the concerts. Then they go to Seattle and create the first light shows, including bringing in symphony orchestras, the Seattle Orchestra. Then they do the first videos. And then he goes on and gets involved with – then he drops out and gets involved with UG Krishnamurti, the satirical version of the famous Krishnamurti. And he is now stranded in Mumbai. Oh, that's James laughing.
Yeah, hey, guys. I was going to say, Bob, you said synesthesia came in with maybe MTV or Amplified, but wouldn't it have come in with the beginning of the alphabet?
Well, that's what's interesting. As you read Coker closely, his term virtuality has the same meaning as any medium that McLuhan calls medium. So St. Augustine was the first virtualizer by creating the abstract idea of the soul, thanks to the phonetic alphabet, which resolved the contradictions of Greek tribal and oral experience. So the beginning of visual space is the beginning of virtuality. That's sort of implied, or that's sort of said very infrequently in Coker's writings. But he talks about how St. Augustine's sensibility and the way he lived at the end of the Roman Empire and the weird dark ages they were moving into, that is very resonant, McCroker wrote back in the 80s, with the postmodern experience. So he said Augustine was relevant to understanding what was coming out of the postmodern writers and just the postmodern lifestyle. And that is exactly what McLuhan had said in his criticism back in the 40s and 50s, that the Christian fathers, the patristic fathers, were, in their sensibility, much like anthropologists, because they had to go around all these different tribes to bring in the alphabet and the Christian mission, and they had to be real careful on who they had to understand the sensibilities and the cultural bias as they interacted with them. So I don't know if Croker knew McLuhan wrote that, but Croker comes back and finds the same thing. Now let's look at Croker as the android meme version of McLuhan. I see McLuhan as part of the android meme, but if you see that the android meme has an after image, which is what my chart is, you see Croker is the after image of McLuhan, and that doesn't mean it's obsolete or weak, it's just it's a totally different language in a different situation. So that Croker purposely, there's this great style where Croker will write, I might some point, someday, read it, he'll write along explaining something, and then he'll start the next paragraph and go, or is it this? And then explain a whole bunch of stuff on another level. Redo what he just said, and then go, well, maybe it isn't that. And then he would give a third view. I've never seen anybody write something and then question it and then write another paragraph about how it could be something else. It's like thinking out a process that you think out before you write. But the very making of the process is what Croker shows, and McLuhan never did that.
Yeah, that's true. And also, just before I just want to get that clear, did you say postmodernism is a replay of St. Augustine's time in the Dark Ages, so to speak?
Yeah, the sensibility that Augustine had, it's almost like at the time of the death of the American world hologram, like Rome back in Augustine's time, and you have the beginning where the barbarians or whoever is going to take over, that cusp, that borderline that Augustine was in, created a kind of sensibility that modern people have to have as they sit in between a world that is dead and a world that cannot be born. They're in between a world that cannot totally die and a world that cannot be totally born. A new world can't be born. So that's the paralysis.
Was Croker the one who pointed this out, or did you just point this out now?
He's the one who points out that Augustine is relevant to our time.
No, but that postmodernism is like a replay of Augustine's time.
Oh, no, he says that. That's his point. He's saying, and that would be what Andrew said, you know, his Catholic seminary teachings. He was able to use his Jesuit training or whatever it was, this obscure stuff from the Catholic Church, and make it relevant to the 80s, just like McLuhan did. He said that modern art, you know, the Picasso and that, were just retrieving the sensibility of the Christian fathers. Now, you know that pagan art societies don't think they're Catholics. You know what I mean? they don't. They think art is against religion. It's generally a pagan meme, and this is in cliche land. I mean, there are great artists who are Catholics, but you don't think that art is replaying a St. Augustine sensibility. And that's what that was one of his main ideas that he spent time trying to explain to Tom Wolfe. Once Tom Wolfe made McLuhan famous, you have letters where he's trying to point out what he was really about, and I don't know if Tom Wolfe ever got it. But Croker, that's why Croker is a replay of McLuhan, but it's a totally different situation. So it has to be a different version of McLuhan.
So many so-called great thinkers miss out on these larger patterns. Yeah, and it's a big shame. I mean, it's not a shame, but
you're saying so many conventional thinkers.
Yeah, they don't even look back 50 years, you know, to make their patterns
who's
up.
Who's they, James? I've got no idea who the James, the they are you're on about.
The ones that I saw at during my media studies degree, they didn't have McLuhan, but they had so-called philosophers and theorists and blah, blah, blah. And they'd just be looking at 50 years, you know, the last 50 years, like Foucault and all these sort of minions. You know, it was all about the female gaze. You know, that was the main focus of philosophical sort of real in-depth study.
The male gaze on the female body.
Yeah,
Yeah. No, that you went through that stuff, Andrew, didn't you, in the 90s?
Yeah, I got a slightly different, actually slightly more obsolete version.
What would that be?
More obsolete than mine.
You mean worse teachers?
Well, no, different. In the end, it's actually starting to pay off, but it's coming through. It was pretty hardcore. Like, my first degree was pretty hardcore Marxism, really, in a way. A lot of Marx, a lot of Lenin, a lot of Engels, and we're Gramsci and
Habermas. Right. Which is the world that Coker was involved in and putting on. Now, here's the interesting thing. It's just like, Dark Matter is outraged that he never even learned McLuhan from Croker, because he was a student of Croker in Winnipeg in the late 70s. And Croker did not mention McLuhan, and Dark Matter forever, when he met me in the 80s, and then since then, over the last couple of years, really grown to appreciate McLuhan thanks to how I presented it to him. He really is pissed that he got ripped off in his education. And we want to get Croker on Mom and grill him about what was his problem.
Well, I mean, my brother did
the
same.
But Croker doesn't rarely show up. Is that what you're...
Say that again?
He declines invitations to...
To any McLuhan stuff. He doesn't decline me. It's just that I'm not active, but Dark Matter can probably get a hold of him. And it could happen, but it's not pressing. I mean, I'll probably do a better job of explaining Croker than Croker. He's a terrible speaker. His voice is android metallic.
I just want to hear Dark Matter give it.
Yeah, oh, okay. You mean do we get Dark Matter? Oh, okay, so you're asking if we get Dark Matter on.
Yeah, and Croker, so that the Dark Matter can yell at him about proper education.
Right. Yes. As a matter of fact, Dark Matter right now, he's so... What, Andrew?
Did you say he was metallic? So he's the perfect speaker. He's the perfect speaker for
whatever. Oh, yeah. Arthur Croker is the voice of, in the popular science fiction voice of a Terminator mind, a Terminator voice. It's very unethical. No, what's the word? Unaesthetic. But the thing about Dark Matter, he's getting such a deep appreciation of McLuhan now in my conversations with him. And it'd be nice to have him part of these, but he can't do it. he would probably disagree with me emphasizing Croker over McLuhan. He's so into discovering the depth of McLuhan, and I understand that. But once he gets used to that depth, then he's got to realize you can't use the language of McLuhan. And Dark Matter has said that once this year is over, he hopes he doesn't have to think about McLuhan again.
You know.
Because he's doing all the graphics on our website. Okay, so back to what James is citing is so familiar, and that is the world that Croker came into in 1984 and brought in McLuhan, and they still, maybe not this year, but even 5 years ago, there were people I knew in Toronto who could not use McLuhan in their papers with their feminist professors. They couldn't even quote him.
Back on it, I think the my professors
Why
were probably
is that?
Scared to
because
bring
he's
him.
He's a man. He's a white male Catholic. What worse? That's the beast. There's a whole feminist tradition that patriarchal European literature is they call the male gaze has destroyed women, and they will not have it. They are going to retrieve the tribe of women.
Well, if it were not for the feminists, I would say that they were that was the effect of, or the cause of that, whatever. The feminists brought that on, the male gaze dilemma, or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
If women hadn't stood up and taken their bras off and wrapped them around people's necks, there wouldn't be any male gazing.
No, but the male gaze, they go back 500 years. They show it in art history. They go back. It's a longer view of it's visual bias in McLuhan terms, which is left hemisphere, which favors the male brain. And the male brain ran culture for 500 years, and the electric environment retrieves the right hemisphere, which women supposedly are favored. So women now are in control because they got the right hemisphere, and they're pissed off at the left hemisphere legacy of culture that their kids are forced, until recently, to learn. Now, all of this, see, this is where McLuhan, Sapp, and Lewis and these people are not in that debate, and neither is Croker, because they see the third factor of the discarnate or the virtualized state that obsolesces any gender differences or class differences and all those issues that the literate feminists are worried about. They're not here anymore. And Madonna represented, that's why Madonna's on my chart, she represented the post-feminist view in the 80s by the next generation of girls. But academia is very slow. And they, you know, Andrew, I wonder how they're doing under the new austerity, that way of thinking, that kind of teaching, under the new academic austerity. You know anything about that?
Bad. Everything's getting locked down, and is part and parcel of the austerity is a new audit style of culture where everything is wildly connected, definitely objectives driven, KPIs measured, and if it can't be documented, then it doesn't exist.
So they're rigidly, it's more of a neocon agenda, back to the right to the left hemisphere visual space, but not pure visual space, I guess.
No, not pure, but it's definitely doing, it's the Twitter version of visual space.
Okay, so what James is talking about, yes, like dark matter, when you find out, you know, the Dobbs knowledge, you see that you got ripped off, and it could have been easily told to you in class and developed, but they, for all kinds of reasons, don't understand it or don't use it. And Croker is in that position himself.
Is it possible that they never used it because they didn't understand it? So how can you...
Yeah, they didn't understand it.
Don't understand.
Well, it would have obsolesced all the other stuff they were trying to teach us at the time, you know, quite frankly.
Yeah, James, this is the broke part I was saying about the University of City. You need lots of newspapers and lots of media content. They wanted many kinds of topics. And if you have McLuhan come in and give you the basics point and erase it all, then there's nothing for the inhabitants of the new city to do. So they wanted a baroque affluence of content. And and that would be the reason you couldn't use McLuhan. It was not relevant. And what could you say? It's art for art's sake. It's university life for university life's sake.
Yeah, just for the sake of it. And it was like they just built a new big library, and it was like, we've got all this content. We can't tell them about McLuhan, man.
Yeah.
Use the library, you know. But 10 years prior to me doing media studies, my brother did it, and he said they taught McLuhan then. So, you know, when these new female professors came in and some of these maybe younger professors took over the media department, they totally just threw them away. They just went, oh, gone.
Yeah, you can almost say that, I mean, women's lib was the chemical body, women aspect. The tribalization, the tribe of women was threatened by the discarnate, general discarnate effects. McLuhan says that the women gathered together themselves and defended their chemical body image. And they, and because the environment, and they didn't know it, favored right hemisphere stuff, then they got to be the content and, in quote, in control for 25 years. But by the 90s, even since you're getting into the post-Android meme, even the right hemisphere dominance or preference was weakened because you're now getting into the corpus callosum with the internet, which is neither right or left hemisphere. It's in between. The tactile interval becomes bigger. So the defensive right hemisphere position of the feminists becomes weakened, and they get ghettoized and become a bunker state in university cities.
I like it. Funny.
And those that's 10 years, 15 years ago, they wouldn't recognize. Yeah. Take someone from that period, a professor or maybe Margaret Atwood or somebody from that period. If they saw what Andrew has to put up with, they'd be shocked probably, right, Andrew?
Yeah, no doubt. It's transformed a lot since then.
So you're going to say something, James?
I was just thinking Jermaine Greer or someone like that.
Yeah, Jermaine Greer. Okay, so shall I read a few? Anybody else want to say something before I read some glossary items?
Yeah, no, all I'd like to say is, Bob, we've got like 25 minutes in the new short Mercenary Metallic Regime here. And so, yeah, let's get straight into some items and then we'll try and maybe sum it all up with a taking some further questions for next week's themes, and then that's us.
Okay, just a second.
Okay,
there's, what'd you say, James?
No, it's just me. I was just wondering about it going completely quiet for a second.
No, I had to do something. So there are many Coker books. There's Spasm. There's The Possessed Individual. There's The Hysterical Male, which is a great book for women to read, all about the power of the clitoris over the penis. And the clitoris is a double sign, a doubled sign. You know, you get a lot of good stuff from Mary Louise Croker. I should say that Arthur always gives kudos to his wife, Mary Louise, as very instrumental in these ideas. They came out of a dialogue with her, it seems. Now, I think that she's an American who came to Canada in the early 70s. I think she was a single mother, and she probably was a student at McMaster in Hamilton. That's probably where Arthur and her met. But she has gone on to win many design awards, because once they had their academic tenure and security in Montreal, they were able to get grants to make their books, and all their books are made by them. They wouldn't be published otherwise back then. They'd be too crazy. So,
They were a formidable
duo.
Croker
is a self-published author? Is that what you're saying?
No, just a minute. What did you say, Andrew?
Yeah, Mary Louise is a really good designer, and I think they were a very powerful force, I think, before she became sick.
Yeah, and what did you say, Tina?
So what you're saying is Croker is self-published?
Yeah, it's self-published. Yeah, now Data Trash, occasionally a book would be picked up by St. Martin's Press. So Data Trash was so good, St. Martin's Press reissued it. So I don't know how many of their books are reissued, but basically it was a whole series called New Perspectives, New World Perspective, Culture Text Series. That was what all the postmodern scene and a bunch of other books. Now, once what Croker did is in the mid-90s, he started C-Theory, standing for Crash Theory. He started ctheory.net, and you can look it up, and he started a intellectual peer-reviewed journal and had all the postmodern greats write for it, and it's considered one of the best academic online publication places going. And so he got status on the internet with C-Theory, and then he was given a chair, and, you know, Sasha, if she's listening, she can go walk over and visit Croker. He lives in and teaches in Victoria, British Columbia.
Life in the Wires.
That's right. Is that Croker? Nice to hear from you, Croker.
Hey, how's your mama and them?
Mom's okay. Them ain't here.
Well, you left out technology in the Canadian mind.
No, we said that, didn't I, Arthur?
You gotta go into it.
That's right. Okay, you're right. We didn't get into it. There's a lot. I'm glad that you're up on this, Arthur.
Well, you're on a time restraint, so we thought we better help where we could.
Yeah, well, you're welcome to come in a minute. Let me just get a few of the terms down, because I'm going to refer to this. It's now MUM, McLuhan under Maui, which you have been saying for a couple of months now. I've been talking about MUM, MUM rather than MOM, so you prefigured this. And do means yes, if you're not aware of that. So so I'll be using Croker as a guideline, because, you know, Andrew, as important as what Marshall wrote, when you look at his – can you take some of the later papers, like when he did late 70s, the paper Figure and Ground and Literary Criticism? All he does is categorize the different schools into his framework. You could not write like that in the 80s. There's two paltries, nothing there. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So you have a Baroque spewing out of written words here by Croker. So here's how he begins it, the Data Trash Glossary. starts off, data trash. No, first of all, it says in capital letters, we are data trash and it's good. That's its opening line. And he says, data trash crawls out of the burned out wreckage of the body splattered on the information superhighway and begins the hard task of putting the pieces of the electronic body back together again. Not a machine, not nostalgia for vinyl, and most certainly not a happy digital camper, data trash is the critical email mind of the 21st century. Data trash loves living at the violent edge where total human body scanning meets an inner mind that says no and means it. When surfs up on the net, data trash puts on its electronic body and goes for a spin on the cyber grid. So that's how he introduces the glossary. Then he begins to define different things. So the first one is Adobe Photoshop Optics. This is defined as digital eyes for quick travel across the recombinant field of digital reality. No longer the vanishing point of perspective as in the Renaissance, virtual reality is an anamorphic space where events unfold in the form of the perverted image. Adobe Photoshop inscribes electronic eyes with scanner vision, layering, pastiching. So you remember Adobe Photoshop in the 90s. That was a... Now, where is that today, James? Is that still...
It's still huge.
Right, and as a matter of fact, I think Adobe Photoshop was designed by Gerd Stern's son. And Gerd Stern is another guy on Dobbstown.com.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, one of his sons is one of the major innovators in this technology back in the 80s and even now. So then I'm going to jump ahead, not do it in alphabetical order, just to get some general terms. Here's how Coker defines virtual reality. Where flesh goes to die and the electronic body struggles to be born at the fend of millennium. Strap on a head-mounted scanner, wire your flesh with digital trodes, slap smell patches on your data suit, and take an out-of-body flight across the outer galaxies of cyberspace. That's virtual reality. I got to take a drink. Just a second. So then the virtual elite is defined as electronic rulers of the information superhighway. Masters of the electronic kingdom, the virtual elite usually swarm in digital hives from Silicon Valley and Chiba City, that's in Japan, to the European cyber grid running from Munich to Grenoble. So that's the virtual elite. The virtual class, the social strata. Now, Coker, as a Marxist, is writing a new manifesto to update the Communist Manifesto. That's why the subtitle is The Theory of the Virtual Class. So Coker, building on McLuhan, but McLuhan didn't get into the details of class warfare or class struggle, but Coker recognized that the traditional battle between the working class, management class, and this wealthy class, I guess, it's complicated by this discarnate or electrified information level, which is what Coker calls the virtual class. So the virtual class is the social strata in contemporary pan-capitalism that have material and ideological interest in speeding up and intensifying the process of virtualization and heightening the will to virtuality. The elite components of this class include technotopians who explicitly advance the cause of virtualization through offering a utopia of juvenile power, in brackets, virtual reality flight simulators in all the entertainment complexes. And then the other guys as part of the class are the cynical capitalists who exploit virtuality for profit. Then you have spasm. This, and he named a book Before Data Trash, Spasm. This is the state of living with absolutely, now this is really interesting, the state of living with absolutely contradictory feelings all the time and really loving it. Fascinated yet bored, panicked yet calm, ecstatic yet terminal, apathetic yet fully committed. First point, terminal shutters that suddenly appear from nowhere, convulse the media net in frenzied attention, and then disappear from view, never to be heard from again. Examples of these terminal shutters are John Bobbitt's missing penis, the L.A. earthquake of early 94, Nancy Kerrigan's knee, another image of convulsion in the media net, the TV image of O.J.'s Bronco on that slow, surrealistic drive down the L.A. freeway, like an electronic Days of the Locust. That was a movie in the 70s, Days of the Locust. And then he cites a sampler music CD by Steve Gibson to take with you on your journey across the electronic frontier. So that's spasm. Now, James, do you remember TIFF The graphic file is called TIFF.
Yeah, still use them.
All right, so he has a section, a term called TIFF psychology. So remember, the technology is alive, so he can put, you know, anthropomorphic themes into this thing. So TIFF itself, it says, in computer graphics, TIFF files are compressed digital code for working in multimedia text. When the electronic body comes alive, TIFF double clicks, so TIFF itself, the files double click out of the language of computer programs, becoming a dominant personality type on the electronic frontier. TIFF personalities always hold something in reserve. Elegant up front, they have about them the seduction of something concealed in their programming stats. Or maybe something different, the way virtual personalities are passed from one net to another, their complexity enfolded in the language of time compression, just waiting for that magic moment to unfold on the screen of electronic life with their previously hidden attributes. So you see, put the projection in there.
What year was this
written? 92. This comes out in 94, but, you know, written in 92, 93.
So, Bob, like, in a certain sense, this is like a paramodernist psychology. Psychology, well, not necessarily psychology in the old sense, but psychology in the sense that it reflects the individualism that was propped up around this time. Yeah?
Yeah. I simplify by saying the Android meme is technology coming alive and then imitating humans and more making humans think that the mediascape reflects them and don't notice that the mediascape is presenting that to them. So the Android meme purposely looks stupider and stupider. You know, he called it the dumber and dumber culture.
To simplify that for a second, you'd go back to the famous question, what does it mean to question technology?
Yes, that's Heidegger's question, I think. That's right. What does it mean to question technology? And McLuhan questioned it, but then when technology then could simulate your questioning, how do you question the questioning that's simulated back at you? That was Croker's problem, and McLuhan didn't really have that problem, even though he wrote and anticipated it. But the point is that Croker brings in the disservices in his account of the new environment more than McLuhan did. Bringing in traditional aspects of sex, class, and race, and those things that McLuhan correctly would not go into because he wanted people to understand the discarnate state first.
Mm.
So that meant McLuhan would be limited in what he would write about. There's much repetition in what he does, depth repetition. But Croker is able to, you know, you look in postmodern scene, he will list 8 aspects of something, like sociological, political, economic, art world. It's just incredible inventories of long, complicated categories and statements. It's actually impossible for someone to read. If people don't read as much today, they won't be able to read that Croker and that early Croker. I don't know. Have you read them, James? Can you read them?
No, I haven't tried, but I'm wondering how relevant. I mean, I like getting your exegesis on them, but if I picked up his book, how relevant I would find them.
Well, it's only catch-up. It's not relevant to what we're doing here, but we live. We don't know how much we... but you don't know how much your concept...
I guess it goes into a cod fishery, doesn't it, Bob?
Yeah, that's Harold Innes' first study. Very good there. See? He knows his stuff.
Well, we aren't as good as we once were, but we're as good once as we ever were.
Yeah, and you're extending that once out to be an interminable, long, long non-time, right?
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Loving every minute of it.
Okay, so what was I saying there? Oh, yeah, so when Ion talks about never mind, James, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you don't know you're thinking that's making you think that you don't know you've got to never mind it. So you go through these schools of McLuhan and Croker to find out thoughts that you don't know you have before you can delete them. See, so
I agree. I like the pattern recognition.
Well, how would you go about deleting something that you don't have?
No, you do have. There's all kinds of thinking. You know, just take the phrase.
How do you delete it?
I guess why would I?
Because you have all times happening in you and all memes. And that's what it means to come into your power, is to have a proper perception of what you are empowered by and what the contents of it are. That's why most New Age or any of the discussion of being power is silly. As a matter of fact, I don't know if I could find it, but a couple of statements by Croker are very relevant to some of the things we're doing, but I can't find them right now, maybe in the future. But the
problem is we don't know what we don't know, do we, Tina?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. How do I delete something that isn't?
Okay, listen to this. This is the paragraph just before the part I started with, reading Croker's Crash Theory on page 142. In the paragraph before, listen to this. Arrayed perfectly against archival politics, which is retrofascism politics, although negatively and symmetrical with its reductionism, stands a historically expansionary domain of combinatorial politics. This is cybernetic liberalism, the new social contract for the network body proposed by the Clinton hologram. Now, see, he's calling Clinton a hologram right at the beginning of Clinton's term. It is also evidenced by Mitterrand's creation of a recombinant state architecture, in brackets, the telemetried Paris Opera House that stands opposite the fading sign of the Bastille. Maybe Sheila went there. The new French National Library with its vaporization of books into information processes and the spreading of the speed network of the TGV. So that's all that Mitterrand was doing. Then Croker says, cybernetic liberalism is combinatorial. It breaks away from the retrieval function in order to create a new telematic matrix. The, quote, digital superhighway of high-speed data, that's in quotes, the digital superhighway of high-speed data is neo-medievalism for the New Age, and he capitalizes New Age for the New Age genre of literature and meme. You know, the Marianne Williamsons and the Shirley MacLaines. Our choice is the archived ego in the selfish me of New Age neo-romanticism, is one choice, or the recombined ego of liberal fascism, where the ego dissolves into a pure extension of telemetry. Cold data warehouses of the electronic mind with a romantic veneer of kitsch medievalism, in brackets, crystals, chants, and wilderness drumming for the hysterical male. That's one choice. Or the virtual mind is a mini theme park filled with spurious desires, strolling voyeurs, and liquid TV flesh. Now, you've never heard those words before, Tina. And if they are thought, then they are there. So you better examine them to know what you're made up of. That's the reason we do this. I mean, we can't know anything until said. So if all this stuff is being said and you don't hear it, you don't know what's happening.
The question
well,
was,
and
which,
even
would
to
you
simplify
it?
That one step further, it gives the difference between the isness and the are-ness of the conversation.
Yeah, I appreciate Ion does make it simple, and it always is
okay.
Useful to present it simple. It's just that it's tactile. You got Ion makes it simple and accurate, and then I complexify it. And both go together, because that's the way your mind is. As you're listening, Tina, to us, you're taking in our words, you're also thinking a whole bunch of other thoughts as a background to your mind. And that may be complex or simple. So you've got to include both tracks of perception, and then other people bring in stuff, and there's two of them every time.
Right.
So it's just developing your perception of what is. And that is beg your pardon?
I'm good with that.
Yeah, so when Ion says that what you see is not reality, that's exactly, in very complex terms, what Croker means by virtuality. He goes through the whole book pointing out that what people see, he calls it fiber optic scanner eyes, he technologizes the simple sense of seeing and shows how it's a trompe-l'oeil, which is, you know, an optical illusion. What is good about Croker is he points out that the fractal image is superseded by the anamorphosis space, or the trompe-l'oeil, the M.C. Escher painting, anamorphosis. The anamorphosis is what Ion has been explaining gradually over the past year and a half on the radio. He's complexified now to the point he doesn't even say that he means to relax and allow. You see? So ion is an anamorphic phenomenon itself, and there are many sections in here that I could read that describe exactly the communication style of ion. But it's, you think of ion as virtuality, and ion is whatever the guff allowed to play in the chip body. That very aspect is what Croker is getting at. But Croker is talking this 20 years ago and in more secular terms.
Bob, how rigorously do you want to adhere to this two-hour kind of thing? I know we're getting going, and there's a great temptation to burst off into a five-hour marathon. Should we take a list of themes or something and keep it fresh for next week? What's people's perception?
Well, I would say we'd only continue if people start to talk. No more lurking. You and I will just not speak and see what they say among themselves. So they can keep it going if they have anything to say. If not, we can end it.
Well, here's something. Let me throw this out here. And if I'm getting to what you were just talking about, someone speaks about a process, shifting their magnetic field. And that's what they are about these days. And then that process shows up in my world. Not that I heard about it; I experience it. And then because it was spoken or had been spoken, even though I didn't hear about it, it showed up anyway. It becomes an R for it. It's an is for me. Like you were. Do you know what you? Do you follow where I'm going at? Just because I don't hear it doesn't mean that it isn't a thought that's said aloud.
Well, I'm encouraging James and Sheila, whoever's here, to answer you, not me or Andrew. I'm talking about you guys talking among yourselves. So, has anybody got a comment on that?
Well, yeah. I'd agree, but I'd also say, I guess, to study it and see the patterns, you know, one has to develop a language and words around it and discuss it and think about it and extend it, I guess. You know, what's next? You know, never stop. So I guess that's what we're trying to do here.
Now, Sheila?
Come on. Sorry, let's kill it there, Bob. I think that's James has actually said it right. It's like and possibly laid down the agenda, if there is such a thing, for the next little while, is developing a new language, moving out of McLuhan into something that's workable and usable for us today.
Okay.
And so let's keep it fresh for next week. We've got a long run ahead of us, so let's not exhaust it. And if anybody who's got some themes or some questions or issues, then email them through, and we'll take them up, or you can be the special guest next week.
Okay, good. All right, thanks for showing up, Andrew.
Oh, thank you, Bob. You're running the show. Thanks to Ion. Thanks, James. Thanks, Sheila and everybody. And hopefully you can join us next week, or we can join you. We can be in that virtual space. So do you want to push the stop button now, Bob, and then we can let it go.
Okay.
Where it goes.
Yeah, I got to go upstairs and disconnect my recording here for a second.
Tina?
Yeah?
I'm sorry. I've got a really bad echo, but I wanted to say before, was it King Biscuit's Flower Hour?
Are you talking about the Friday night concerts on TV?
Yes.
Could be. I don't, you know, it was pretty high at the time. Getting home from the Friday night